From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Spencer Tracy was one of the great actors of Hollywood's golden age, equally adept at drama and comedy. The Academy Award-winning actor is probably best remembered for the series of films he made with actress Katharine Hepburn, with whom he had a long relationship. One of the great film historians, James Curtis, is my guest. He has written biographies of Preston Sturges, W.C. Fields, and James Whale. His latest book is Spencer Tracy, a biography. James Curtis, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary.
Spencer Tracy, a biography, it's 1,000 pages long. What compelled you to write such an exhaustive account of...
Well, what happened was, I'm not the only one that does this, but when I'm working on something like this, I'll put into the first draft anything that could conceivably find its way into the published book, and then it's a matter of paring it back afterwards. And in this case, the original manuscript was something like 1,550 pages. It was a long thing, and as I did put everything in that I possibly could have, it then became a matter of conferring my editor, what can we take out, how long do you want this thing to be, and there was a point at which it was a conscious decision that we had a really unique subject in Tracy. I mean, he was a major figure, debatably the greatest American actor of his time, and so it wasn't like we were doing Sonny Tufts or somebody like that. So we thought that we had kind of a unique opportunity to do a biography on a figure of this stature that really kind of took you through, in some ways, the day-to-day routine of being a major attraction in motion pictures at the time that he was. And so the decision was made to, at a certain point, let it run the distance. There were a lot of things we could have taken out of it that you would never have missed, but it was a conscious decision at some point to leave a lot of that material in, and I think we made the right decision. I mean, there'll never be another book quite like this one in that regard.
I can't think of any biography of any actor that is as long, maybe the two volumes or something on Orson Welles or something.
But. Well, yeah, that could be. What we were trying to do, what I was trying to do, was come at the subject from every conceivable direction. So there's a lot in there about his relationship with his son. There's a lot about his wife. There's a lot about his technique as an actor, which you don't find in a lot of biographies of actors. I think a lot of authors are afraid of discussing technique. I specifically wanted to get into that. I'd like to see how the wheels turn with a creative figure such as this. But, you know, you've got the alcoholism, you've got the Catholicism, the Irish heritage in his family, the business side of being a movie star, the demands that were placed upon you at that time, what was like being an employee of MGM at that time. There were a lot of things that worked into it, and so all of those things applied.
Well, let's talk about him as a great actor. What sets him apart from his contemporaries, Gable, Bogart, Fonda, John Wayne?
Well, he was a very modern actor, and that's one point I like to make when discussing this book. It's not a movie star biography, it's an actor's biography, and I think that Tracy is almost of the top tier attractions of that time, the guys that could open a film simply because their name was above the title. I think Tracy was by far the finest actor of that group. It doesn't necessarily mean that there were other guys such as Gary Cooper and Clark Gable who were uniquely suited to the camera and who came across very well on camera and could acquit themselves very admirably. But Tracy was a guy that I think had a very modern approach to acting for that period of time. He did it all internally. He did it all from within. And a lot of those guys, you know, Gable, Gary Cooper, et cetera, those guys were personalities, I think, first and foremost. Tracy was first and foremost an actor, and that's why you don't see any impressionists doing Tracy.
Right. Well, what about his technique? What can you give us some concrete examples of superlative performances?
Well, I can cite about a third of his films, which I think are just tremendous, not only in terms of his work, but in terms of general content. I mean, you go back to, he did 74 feature films, and so you go back to early things like The Power and the Glory, Quick Millions, Fury, and I think one of the reasons why he became so popular and so well regarded in the mid to late 30s, once he went to MGM, was that he showed a tremendous range for that time. He could play screwball comedy. In a very short period of time, he did San Francisco, where he played a priest, Fury, which was as close to an art film as MGM got in that period, Captain's Courageous, where he played the Portuguese fisherman, Libeled Lady, which was a screwball comedy, They Gave Him a Gun. I mean, they gave him a tremendous array of challenging roles at that point, and he came through with such in such a memorable fashion that within a period of literally months of his coming to MGM, he was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actor, the second nomination he won, and the third nomination he won. But the story of his approach, his technique as an actor, goes back to when he was a child in Milwaukee. And I always like to say that his first great influence as an actor was Bronco Billy Anderson, because he would sit as a kid in these Nickelodeons and watch the same films over and over and over again, and he would internalize these parts, these stories, and go back and replicate the action in the living room of their house. And he would charge people admission, and so at the age of 10, 12, 15, he was learning to do in a very basic, rudimentary fashion what he later formalized and did in films, that he could imagine himself, he could place himself in the position of a particular character, and just instinctively bring an aspect of himself to a part. And I think most actors, that's what they strive for. What of me intersects with this character? And I think that's what Tracy came across at a time back in the 20s, especially the early 1920s, when he certainly wasn't matinee idol handsome, but he was in an odd sort of way preparing for a time when he could put himself across as an actor on screen, and looks didn't matter that much. I mean, he at that point came across as an everyman, and a nice contrast to people like Barrymore and Clark Gable, who were especially Gable, who were creatures of the camera, creatures of film. Nobody in real life looked like Clark Gable, but Tracy was the guy that lived next door.
Well, we're talking with James Curtis, and his latest book is a biography of Spencer Tracy. Spencer Tracy didn't even really make a hit film until he was in his mid-30s.
No, he didn't. And that's one of the things about his life as an actor. I mean, he didn't really get into films until his life was almost half over. I mean, he was 30 years old. So there was a tremendous amount of time that he spent on stage in an American stock, which was a tremendous training ground. But he was unusual as a stock actor in that stock was the place where one did one's work with putty noses and crepe beards and that sort of thing, and the more traditional British approach to acting from the outside in. And he startled audiences because a lot of times he wouldn't wear makeup. He didn't like wearing makeup, and he didn't photograph well in makeup. So as he got into films, the early tests he did were with makeup, and he didn't look right. And when John Ford picked him out of The Last Mile on Broadway and put him in his first feature film, he said, he's not going to wear makeup in my film. And he didn't. He got a good tan, and he was able to photograph without it. And after that, he was he wore makeup very little in films.
Well, I want to ask you two questions at once, and you can...
Sure. I'll answer them at once.
All right, good. What is the difference for Spencer Tracy in the way he approached acting on the stage and the way he approached acting in film? And then how did he approach comedy as opposed to drama?
Well, he always claimed that he never did anything differently in front of a camera that he did on stage. And I think to him that was probably true, because the same basic thing that he did, the working from within, the classic method approach without really being trained in the method or conscious of that, applied. I mean, what he did that was different was basically mechanical. I mean, he lowered his voice a bit, but he wasn't playing to the gallery. But at the same time, the same basic internalization of the character applied there. And that's why I think he played comedy so well, was because, again, everything he did was based on character. And if the character was funny, then he could be funny. But always in a way that was believable and natural. He never played farce in a way where he lost touch with the character as a believable, credible human being. And I'm trying to think if there's a film where he really did lose touch, and I can't think of one offhand. I'm not sure he was capable of losing touch.
He's as physical a comedian as anyone.
Yeah, he was. No, I think the main thing, he talks a bit in the book about George M. Cohan, who was his great mentor on stage in New York, coaching him on what to do with his hands on stage. Don't be a lazy actor. Don't put your hands in your pockets, that sort of thing. So Tracy on stage, and I think this is true, a big difference in some respects, actors that or film personalities who started in front of the camera as opposed to stage-trained actors. When you're on stage, your entire body is visible, and a good stage-trained actor knows how to work with every aspect of his body, you know, so the part of the conveyance of character comes from how one carries oneself, how you walk, how you use every aspect of your equipment, in effect. And so Tracy knew how to walk funny. He could imply character with any aspect of his physical self. And again, if the character was funny, then he would be funny.
Well, James Curtis, you also wrote about W.C. Fields, and alcohol played a major role in the lives of both Fields and Tracy. Was that something you were particularly interested in, or can you contrast the effects of alcohol addiction on these two men?
Well, I think I understand alcoholism to some degree, because I've had personal experience with it, not myself, but in my family. And I'm drinking was so common in those days. I mean, everybody did it. It's like smoking cigarettes. But I think it's important when you're dealing with alcoholism to some writers, some biographers have a knee-jerk reaction to alcoholism or any kind of what might be perceived as a personal failing, and there's a judgmental quality in their writing and how they approach the person, and I avoid that as much as possible, because I don't think that. I think in cases like Fields and Tracy, they were working with the cards that were dealt them, and in some cases they triumphed in spite of those problems. In other cases, they took them and turned them to an advantage. You know, the old cliche about being handed lemons and making lemonade out of them. I think that Tracy specifically, because he was, and I say this without irony really, but he was a very moral man, and I say that in the sense that one of the things that I think is signal in his life is the fact that he so disapproved of how he lived his life, because he had a high standard, a high religious standard that I think was embedded in him at a very, very early age, and his father as an example of someone that he wanted to be like. I think that someone like that struggled very, very hard against what he perceived in himself as being moral failings or failings of an artist also. I mean, he took his work very seriously, and when he personally didn't feel that he had lived up to the promise of his work in a particular role, he despised himself for that also. And so there's this tremendous black core of self-loathing in him that I think was a source of great energy when he could turn it loose on a part. Cohan one time said of his favorite actors, he always knew that they had more in reserve than they were showing you, and I think that was very true of Tracy. But when you see him in a very powerful role, like, say, Judgment at Nuremberg or Inherit the Wind, there's a part of him that is fascinating because you sense there's an almost unpredictable thing about it. It's like he could explode at any moment. He could go in a completely unanticipated direction, but he still had that gravitas that was necessary. And that's the same thing that's true with W.C. Fields. I mean, Fields used it in a much different way, but I think that Fields' use of alcohol was to help steady him, make him a better performer, and he worked it into the act during Prohibition when it was good for laugh lines. Eventually it overtook him. Both of these guys struggled with something they couldn't control fully, but they learned how to turn it to their advantage in both cases.
Well, when you talk about him as a moral person, and you know, there's an interesting thing that happens with actors and the roles they play. We tend to confuse them. You know, we confuse Henry Fonda with the roles that Henry Fonda played, or something like that.
Yeah, sure.
But I guess the one area of Tracy's life where he was the most hypocritical from a moral standpoint would be in marriage.
Mm-hmm. Well, but at the same time, I think that was. It was a non-traditional marriage, if you look at it in terms of Dick and Jane, Ozzie and Harriet. But at the same time, it was a very solid marriage in its own way. I think that one of the things that it's important to remember, I believe, is that human relationships take all kinds of odd forms, and that. If you look at it in terms of what someone might traditionally define as a good marriage, you would probably define this one as not a good marriage. But it resulted in some remarkable things, not disincluding the two children that came from that marriage. But I think that Spencer and Louise Tracy were a remarkable combination in terms of what ultimately came out of their marriage, which was something that lasted until Spencer Tracy's death, but which was also an internationally renowned institution, which was the John Tracy Clinic, which was founded in 1942 and is still here 70 years later.
And I think your book is the first one that gives us a look at Louise as a person,
mm-hmm.
and I appreciated that very much. But, of course, his relationship with Katharine Hepburn is pretty central to the legend of Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, it's central to the legend, but it must be remembered that he was 41 years old when he met Katharine Hepburn, and so a lot of his life came before he ever had any direct contact with her. I think Louise was very much responsible in a great many ways for the success that he ultimately achieved in films. She was his cheerleader, his supporter. She was an elder figure in terms of she was already very much established in the field of dramatic stock when he was just out of drama school. He went to the American Academy in New York. And so they had a lot of life behind them. They were married in 23 when Katharine Hepburn came up at 41. He had been involved with other women up to that point, of course. But None of those relationships really lasted beyond a standard period of time, with the exception of his relationship with Loretta Young, and I think that was significant because they were both Roman Catholics, and so for one time only, as far as I'm aware, in his relationships or his catalog relationships, he shared a common faith with the woman he was involved with, and I think that made for a deeper relationship. He took his religious convictions very seriously, I think, and when that blew apart, it blew apart because of the church. A priest refused to give her absolution unless she went to counseling, and there was a point at which that relationship was not going to go on unless one or the other broke away from the church, and that was something that ultimately was not going to happen. But by the time Katharine Hepburn came along, he was a wreck physically and emotionally, and I think without question she sustained him to a point where he survived a lot longer than he would have otherwise. I mean, that was rescuing him from that particular tar pit of despair was something Louise was not equipped to do. She couldn't deal with his alcoholism. Hepburn knowingly inserted herself into the circumstance and situation and did what she could. She admired Tracy tremendously. She loved him very much. And so that's it's where the story kind of takes a left turn, and you don't know quite what's going to happen. Well, you know in retrospect, of course, but in telling the story, I was very much concerned about telling it chronologically because of all the irony that comes from the knowledge that you have of the early part of his life.
Yeah, you don't use hindsight in telling the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something that Katharine Hepburn says in the book that I thought was interesting, relating to how we were talking before about the technique as an actor of Spencer Tracy.
Mm-hmm.
Both Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy had had success on the stage, and both had been trained as stage actors. And Katharine Hepburn talks about how she didn't mind doing tons and tons of takes, but that Tracy was the best in his first take.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wonder how a first take actor can shine in the last mile on the stage.
Well, it was true. I mean, he was in the moment on stage, and I think in front of a camera he was the same way. I think Katharine Hepburn was not as confident as she portrayed herself as being sometimes. I think that there were a lot of insecurities in Katharine Hepburn, and she was very much open to different interpretations of a particular character, a particular scene, and she would rehearse all day if they would let her. Tracy worked through his material at night. He one of the things he suffered from was insomnia, so he could not sleep more than, you know, 4-3 hours a night, something like that. And so he would spend that time working through the script and preparing for his next day, something he didn't like to tell people he did. But because of that, when he came in, when he came onto the studio floor, he was ready to go. He knew what he was going to do. He knew how he was going to do it, and he really didn't need the help of the director. And Hepburn was perfectly happy to work with a director that she trusted, particularly someone like George Cukor. Tracy didn't need that. He knew what he was going to do. And I think that with Tracy, what he was ultimately striving for was a performance that was inevitable. It was something that had to come out that way just because of who he was, his understanding of the character, and what the material was that he had to work with. I think Hepburn was very different in terms of her technique, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why they became so interesting as a couple.
Was Spencer Tracy satisfied with his talent as an actor?
I think he was conflicted about that. I think there were a lot of times when he was unhappy with his own work because he's, you know, and this is the constant problem for a great artist, is that you see this kind of perfection as the goal, but of course it's never achievable, but you always know what it could have been. And I think that was true with Tracy. I think that he had trouble watching himself on screen. When one of his films was previewed or put together, it was Louise who went, not he. And he would call her immediately thereafter and get her analysis. He trusted that implicitly more than anybody else, and that continued on until, you know, the last films that he did that she could see. He always wanted to know what Louise thought, and Louise's opinion was always sacrosanct.
Well, it's obvious, you know, from the 1,000 pages that you spent a long time with Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, 6 years.
And so how does it feel now that the book is done? I mean, do you miss Spencer Tracy?
Well, I'm still with him in a sense. I mean, on January 7th, will be the start of a 3-month retrospective at the UCLA Film Archive of Spencer Tracy's films, both rare and not commonly seen, as well as some of his major things. And so I'm still in the midst of his work as an actor, and it's I should say also, though, it's the book is 1,001 pages, but there's a lot of back matter in there. The actual text is 878.
We don't want to intimidate people.
Don't want to intimidate people. It's only 878 pages. So,
it's a great read, I think.
Well, thank you very much. To do this work, I think, correctly, you really immerse yourself in the subject to the point where what he does and the events of his life make sense in the same way that the movements of a dramatic, of a fictional character might. And it takes a while to shake that. I mean, there was a period of time when I couldn't watch W.C. Fields after finishing that book on him. I still enjoy him very much, and I can watch him now. But there's a period of time when you've immersed yourself so completely that it's tough to go back and see them the same way as you did before.
I was surprised to hear that one of his films, The Power and the Glory, is essentially a lost film.
Well, it was. In a sense, there were two major restorations that were done of The Power and the Glory. It was destroyed, the master negative was destroyed in a fire in the 30s in New Jersey, I believe. And the writer Preston Sturges, who became very prominent, of course, in the 1940s as both a writer and director, one year some friends got together and tried to assemble a print of The Power and the Glory with what remained. And part of it was a 16-millimeter print that they were able to find somewhere in France. And there were times when Spencer Tracy broke into French during the course of it, but it was as good as they could get. And so in the 1970s at the American Film Institute, a rudimentary restoration was attempted, and they managed to put it together in such a way so that you could see what was there, but it was in really rough shape. And the same gentleman, an old friend of mine, Bob Gitt, was able to go back about, 10 years ago now, and some new 35-millimeter material became available on The Power and the Glory. And they were able to go back and really do a wonderful job with it. Now the film is very, very watchable. It's as complete as we can tell, anyway. It's complete. And that'll be one of the films, in fact, that UCLA will be showing here in Los Angeles very soon.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, it is.
Well, this book, Spencer Tracy, a biography, like all of James Curtis's book, you know, if you're interested in a history of Hollywood and really finding out what it was like, you know, in the golden age, then this is a great book to read. And that we've just sort of skimmed, obviously, the surface of this gigantic book. And James Curtis, thank you so much for spending some time with us. And I hope you come back and give us a second chance when it comes out in paperback.
Well, my pleasure, Gary. It was great talking with you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kuspe.org or find us on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank my guest, James Curtis, author of Spencer Tracy, A Biography. Thanks also to production assistant Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.